The Guardian.
People should really make a big effort to work out what the reasonable odds are for what might happen in the future if they do X, Y, and Z. Having done that, they should then do what they damn well feel like. Yeah.
From a walk in the park to a walk on the moon, risk and how we gauge risk is all important. But are we any good at risk analysis? Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and welcome to this week's Science Weekly. We hope you're listening to this in safety, or if in danger, it's self-elected and moderate, because you're about to hear an extended conversation with statistician David Spiegelhalter and author and journalist Michael Blastland. Together, they've penned an insightful and witty exploration of stats called The Norm Chronicles, Stories and Numbers About Danger. The book creates very believable archetypal characters, the eponymous Norm, a very much Mr. Average, along with the more reckless Kelvin and a hypercautious Prudence. These characters find themselves in dilemmas that are all too familiar to all of us, from the risk of boozing and smoking to the risk of doing that charity skydive. Well, familiar to some of us. So grab your calculators, sit back, listen, and learn. David, Michael, welcome both to the podcast. Your book, The Norm Chronicles, is about a chap called Norm. I'm assuming he's normal slash average. Does one of you want to take me through first who Norm is and how you came up with this magical character?
Norm. Well, we wanted somebody who was average because it's a very particular characteristic of probabilities that they describe be average probabilities, all risks. The kind of, whenever you see them stated, they're average. So we wanted some character who was as close as possible to realizing this kind of slightly abstract notion. And we made him flesh and blood, Norm. What kind of person is he? Well, he's, I like to think of him as a sort of Icarus with a spreadsheet, really. He's Icarus in a cardigan, even better. He has this idea that he can rise above normal human anxiety, normal human fear, the threat, the discomfort that risk induces in a lot of people. Not everybody, but a lot of people. If only he can understand the odds. So probability, he looks on as a kind of savior. You know, I will escape all these earthly cares if only I can understand what's going to happen. It's a way of thinking about what's likely to happen to you. What's your fate going to be?
So if I can understand all the probabilities and the sort of chances of things happening, I can somehow guide my destiny.
If I can reduce them to mathematical probabilities, yeah, you know, then I will be able to surmount the normal uncertainty that everybody else copes with. Or at least I'll be able to put it into perfect proportion and then I can make judgments.
David, is this concept that by understanding all of the risks around you, all of the probabilities that you will be able to use, you know, surface above it all, is it even possible?
Well, no, but I'm a statistician, and so I identify with Norm quite well.
Oh, I see.
We were going to make him actually a statistician because he's someone who tries to be this sort of rational human being that certain members of my profession and many people in science feel we should be. The sort of people of whom I have a number of colleagues who say, oh, God, the public are so stupid. If only they were rational and really knew what the risks were, then they wouldn't make such a fuss about X, Y, and Z. Now, so we thought, well, let's try to make Norm then completely rational and try to be this perfect, you know, person who balanced everything.
So is Norm a perfect person? I mean, the tales could take you from birth to death.
Well, poor Norm has to struggle with his attempt at rationality because he's buffeted by events. He's buffeted by people around him who don't think this way at all. We've got these characters that, basically the sort of slightly cartoon-like characters, one of whom is enormously reckless and thoughtless and just goes for absolutely everything in a sort of maniac way. And another one
is Kelvin.
Kelvin, yeah. And another one, Prudence, which is slightly corny name for her, who's enormously cautious, and wipes everything with wet wipes and is desperately concerned about every story in the newspapers and every risk that might happen to her. And these are archetypes, but of course, actually in real life, all of us are a mixture between these and we vary, throughout the day and what we're looking at, how we are influenced by things. So, I mean, it's a sort of our little personal fight against this, the idea that one can, in fact, be a rational human being.
Are you railing against the over-rationalization then? Is that what you're sort
to
of
some extent,
to do?
And yet we've also got we are very fond of Norm, and we have a sneaking, we got more than a sneaking admiration. We actually think this is a really admirable thing to do, but inevitably doomed, or, you know, inevitably insufficient.
Yeah. I think it's quite, you have to recognize that the data is still hard stuff. It's all we've got, you know, in some ways, in trying to understand what's going on out there in the world. But it's subject to all kinds of human perceptions and human failings and judgments, and actually quite a lot of necessary subjectivity. You know, so you have to kind of reconcile these two things. Yes, we love the data. You know, we're both data geeks, and we think there's enormously powerful information in there. It can be quite revelatory. You know, you can, some of the numbers in the book, you know, you look at, and they are a bit jaw-dropping, and they might change people's behavior. But, you know, we've tried to find the best ways we can to represent these things in order that people can use them to make judgments. But they have to be mixed with their own judgments. There's just no way of stating them as some kind of objective fact about the world out there. I mean, our view is that they don't exist in that kind of form. There's no such thing as an objective external probability for the events that might happen.
So this is something interesting. I was going to come to this later, but you've brought it up already, Michael. So let's talk about this. There's no such thing as probability, David. This is what you say.
Yeah, in the book. I mean, this book is my sneaking attempt to bring what in a technical. I can be technical in a podcast like this.
Can I throw my textbooks away?
Great. Yeah. No. Not at all. But I come from this what's called a subjectivist Bayesian upbringing.
Of course, you do.
Statistics.
I thought that as soon as I saw you.
Exactly. I'm a subjectivist Bayesian, so I was indoctrinated and still hold this basic belief that probability does not exist. It's not a property of the external world. Any probability that we assess is a relationship between us and the world, and it depends on our judgments and our knowledge, and it's contingent on what we know. It's never the probability. The probability is not there, except possibly at a subatomic level, but we're not dealing with that.
We're not talking about quantum mechanics.
No, we don't deal with the quantum-y stuff. For goodness sakes, come on. We're talking about important things here, not the real world. Yeah, we're talking about the real world actually affects us.
Never let any quantum physicist hear this conversation.
Other people make programs around. We don't care about that nonsense. No, we're concerned with real things, and that any probability statement, any risk statement, is something that's constructed on the basis of your current knowledge. And that's what we basically, you know, agree. At the same time, of course, you know, what have you got when you have to make a decision? You've got limited amounts of knowledge, and you have to try to work out what are reasonable betting odds for the situation. Now, any betting odds that you assess are always inadequate. They're not, you know, maybe the thing's going to happen anyway, you just don't know. So it's they're always a judgment, but they're also a really good thing to do. So we eventually came to a conclusion of, you know, people have asked, well, you know, what's the moral of the book? You know, how does it tell us what to do? And we decided, well, we really think that people should really make a big effort to work out what the reasonable odds are for what might happen in the future if they do X, Y, and Z. Having done that, they should then do what they damn well feel like.
Yeah. Well, you know, it might be worth just here getting a 2-minute lesson on. Well, we've now got rid of probability, but probability statistics, for those who aren't familiar with it, and how it works, and then going into what you talked about, Bayesian probabilities and statistics. Okay. So just to the difference between the two. So, you know, a probability is saying something like something has a 1 in 1,000 chance of happening, for example. And they can be independent variables, i.e., you know, the chance of two independent things happening that are 1 in 1,000 are 1 in 1,000 times 1 in 1,000, which is 1 in 1,000,000. If they're not independent, then they're somehow related. You add the probabilities together. Mm-hmm. Bayesian probabilities.
Well, the point is the maths of probability is fine, no matter, you know, what you said holds for complete Bayesian probabilities. The crucial thing is what it means. You said independence. Well, independence is an assumption. You impose independence on the thing by making an assumption. They may or may not be independent because of factors you don't know about. So that, you know, if I flip a coin, you'd think I was independent, but I always carry a two-headed coin, you know, so in which case they're certainly not independent because whatever the first one was is exactly what the second one's going to be as well. So, you know, it depends, these assumptions, the 1 in 1,000, what does that mean, 1 in 1,000? Yeah, the only meaning that makes any sense to me is that this is a judgment based on the knowledge we have that I would be, you know, just as happy to bet on that happening as something which there was, you know, as a completely random number occurring between, you know, in a 1 in 1,000, you know, a completely random number chosen from 1 to 1,000 coming up as 47 or something like that. And that's all it means. It's a judgment made with a comparison.
But it also means that
of an exact method.
If something has a 1 in 1,000 probability of happening, it means if you did that thing 1,000 times, it's going to happen. You're going to get this result.
No, possibly.
No,
possibly.
Possibly not.
Only if all those thousand, if it, under the assumption of a very specific circumstances of exactly equal situations have repeated exactly the same. So mathematically, what you're saying is absolutely correct. It's just what we're talking about is where does that math come into real life?
So take us into the Bayesian side of this, because this is where it gets interesting for decision making.
So, decision making, the Bayesian perspective is that these probabilities are judgments, and we have to acknowledge that, and they're based on what we know. And therefore, all the best we can do is to use these probabilities in our decision making. But one part of it is, of course, recognizing the inevitable inadequacy of that. These are not the true probabilities. You know, you can put me through a computer program, and it'll say I've got a 12% chance of a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years. Well, you can't unzip me and see 12% written. You know, that's not my chance. Who knows? Maybe I'm going to, maybe I'm not. You know, maybe it's karma, God's will, you know, written in the stars, completely determined by the current state of my molecules. Who knows? You know, and the point is that that 12% is just based on a few variables. It's what somebody with a few measurements would be willing to bet. You know, what odds would be reasonable for them to take on me having, I hope no one's betting on me having a heart attack or stroke, but if William Hill were going to open an account, those would be reasonable odds to put on it.
So where do these numbers come from then? If you know, what happens to an individual is dependent on all these mysterious things that we can't measure, but we do have this figure of, let's say, 12%. Where does that number come from?
Oh, it comes from comparing me with a large database of people with a certain of the similar age, blood pressure, cholesterol level, gender and ethnicity and things like that. So if putting me in that group, 12% of people like that who share those characteristics, yeah, a good database probably will.
So that means 12% of those people will end up having a heart attack or stroke. You
can't tell which of them.
Yeah.
And the point is, I might be one of the 12, and you know, or one of the 88. And the crucial thing is, there aren't 100 people like me anyway. You know, we're all different. We're all unique. My genes will certainly make me different from all those other people. But so when we say, and it's we use it in the book, that you know, very good way to communicate these risks that's been shown to people or assessed risks is to say, of 100 people like you, how many would expect to have a heart attack or stroke? There aren't 100 people like me. This is purely a metaphor. And so we emphasize this a lot. Any of these words, language, numbers, we invent all sorts of numbers for this. These are just metaphors that we use. They are not the absolute, you know, truth about numbers. Probability is really tricky stuff. I mean, other units in height, weight, temperature, you've got little scales. You've got thermometers, you've got rulers, you've got scales. What have you got for probability? Absolutely nothing.
Comparisons, I suppose.
Comparisons, exactly. Yeah. All you've got is perhaps an idea of a computer that can draw numbers at random. Let's assume that does exist. I'm willing to admit that exists. All you've got are comparisons with that computer. And judgments about which is more likely to happen.
So in my attempts to make statistics and risk sound simpler, we've made it more complicated already. Let's bring it back to the book then, because I think that actually the book does a really good job of making it simpler. So we're sort of going into baroque areas of philosophical definitions here,
exactly.
Almost.
That's the last chapter.
The qualifications are important, because we don't want to suggest to people that there's some kind of definitive statement of their life chances enclosed in this book. You know, this is not the seat. This is not their fate written between the covers.
Let's now try and do that anyway, because I think that's what people are going to be interested in as well. I mean, with all the caveats we've just talked about, it's worth talking about how you use this stuff and how to understand it properly, because it is something that people just shy away from and don't understand. So how do you, if it is a metaphor, David, if it is something that is partly data and partly emotions, Michael, how do you start to say to people, this is how you use these numbers? You could just sort of think to yourself, well, it's all out there, so just forget about it. Carry on eating those Mars bars and smoking those cigarettes.
Well, you could throw up your hands and say either it is or it isn't, and, you know, fate will take its course. You can do that.
But can you tell me something's dangerous or not?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that on average, you know, in the past, this has had an effect of this size. Yeah. You know, so eating Mars bars or eating sausages or whatever, or drinking so much seems to be associated with. We can do those kind of things, and we can tell you the size of that association. And we can use past data. And then what we're really doing when we say that this is the risk, or when it's said that this is the risk, is we're taking that historical data and we're saying it's your chance. But as David says, that's done with enormous imprecision. And, you know, it has to be qualified in all kinds of ways. There may be all kinds of factors of which we're unaware that might tilt this risk one way or the other. So that's really the exercise that we're involved in here.
But it's
and
a
so it's a
exercise.
Two-part. One of them is trying to understand what those probabilities are, as best we can state them as averages and all the rest of it. And then the other one is thinking about in what ways might they miss. You know, and in what, and then possibly a third part. In what ways might you perceive them initially? And that's going to, that maybe that will be a bigger, have a bigger effect on your decision making than the probabilities themselves, because they become filtered by us according to our own preferences and values and so on. So that's a, that's another important characteristic of the way that we're finally going to come to a decision.
David?
Well, that's why we try to invent, you know, use very simple units to make comparisons, because the book is full of comparisons, and often they quite uncomfortable comparisons, and that's deliberate, because I think the real power of trying to put numbers on these things, even knowing they're very rough, they're just ballpark figures, it enables us to actually look at things side by side in a way that people have been very reluctant to do. We know the trouble that David Nutt got in by comparing, taking ecstasy with addiction to horse riding, equacy as he called it, and saying they're broadly similar risk. Now, this was clearly, it was fascinating to watch, because this was clearly deeply culturally uncomfortable to many people, including the Home Secretary. And it's exactly that stuff, of course, that we find completely riveting, because it's something which is actually taking data, past data. They're both, you know, taking drugs and going horse riding. They're both activities. You know, they're fun. People undertake them for fun. They're done by young people. They're done voluntarily. So in many ways, they're deeply similar activities. They're not like comparing being exposed to living next to a nuclear power station or something with having a gin and tonic, because those are the sort of things that people, you know, find. And these are comparing things what you are completely in control of, things you're not in control of. The drug taking and the horse riding seem eminently comparable in many ways, except for the fact that one is wholesome and one isn't. And of course, that's an absolute incentive to start comparing, as we do, heroin with hang gliding, etc., etc.
Heroin with hang gliding. This is, of course, David Nutt, who was formerly the government's drug advisor until he was sacked after this and many other things, where he compared ecstasy, taking ecstasy, to the risk of taking ecstasy and dying, and the risk of horse riding and dying, and the risks are comparable, it seemed.
Roughly.
Yeah,
they're not far apart.
Yeah. I mean, we've got these unit which
he was being mischievous.
With a serious purpose, and we're trying to follow in his footsteps.
Well, so if the comparisons are difficult, and you find it, you're trying to find this unit, and you've come up with this unit called the micromort, which is a way of quantifying activities in terms of how much time they take off your life, essentially.
That's the micro life.
The
micromort is acute risk.
Risk.
So that's the thing that's going to knock you out.
Why don't one of you explain it?
I'll do the micromort. Yeah, you can do micromort. Micromort is the idea that we can produce a baseline against which every risk, acute risk, can be measured. So acute risks are the kind that can knock you out and thank you and good night abruptly. They're the sudden accidents, the murders with the chainsaw and all of that kind of thing. And we base this on the historical average probability, with all the cautions around those words that you'd expect, that someone will die from external causes. The chance of that happening is about 1 in 1 million in England and Wales. So about 1 in 1 million people each day will die of some sudden external cause. So we're not talking about cancer and things like that. We're talking about the accidents and similar things.
Car accidents and violence.
So you can then use that, because you can, and we call that one micromort, 1 in 1 million chance of dying. We use that as a benchmark against all other risks. So we can again take these average probabilities and compare them. And we can say, you know, for example, hang gliding is what, about 10, David?
About eight.
Skydiving between about 7 and 10, depending whether you're an expert or
I've got here, driving 333 miles.
That's about one micromort.
And that compares to walking 27 miles.
Yeah.
Why is
again,
walking
one
so
micromort.
Much?
Yeah.
Walking 27 miles, driving 333, in terms of, they're both one. They're very similar. Is it because walking is more dangerous? Is that what it means?
well,
I suppose it takes more time to walk 27 miles.
You can do them by per hour.
You can do per time.
Well.
Would be another way of thinking about it.
But the miles, because it makes walking and cycling per distance is very similar, which is sort of.
So you get some interesting things here. Running a marathon is 6 micromorts, whereas driving, as I said, 333 miles is 1 micromort. Mm. You'd think that running a marathon is good for you. You know, lots of health benefits.
Well, it is in some ways.
this is where we come into the difference between acute risk and chronic risk, and the fact that running the marathon or exercise in general, going out running, jogging, it might be good for you in the long run. Similar cycling a long way, but you may get killed doing it. And so there's some trade-off there about acute risk, which we measure by micromorts, which we didn't invent, unfortunately. That was done by Ron Howard. And chronic risks, or chronic benefits of good lifestyle.
This is where microlife,
which are microlives, which we did invent.
So tell me what a microlife is.
So a microlife is something basically we call it a millionth of your life. And a millionth of an adult life. A young adult can expect to live about another 55 or 60 years. So you can think of that really as an adult lifespan. It turns out very neatly that 57 years is a million half hours. Mm. So a young adult has got a million half hours to get through on average. Now, how are they going to fritter those away? You know, there's 48 a day just sort of disappearing underneath them. But so they, you know, you can sit and watch the Eurovision Song Contest.
When you say a million half hours, I mean, just I cycle through episodes of Frasier like nobody's business.
No, yeah, that's one gone every time. Every episode of thing.
Never watching that again.
No, exactly. It's half one gone just like that. Yeah, and of course, it's more than that if sitting watching television, because what you find out is that epidemiological studies of lifestyle are expressed in terms, or can be expressed in terms of the expected change in your life, life expectancy, average change in life expectancy, if you have a particular lifestyle. And you can translate, what we do then is translate them back to the effect of each day's activity. So we can roughly translate that sitting 2 hours in front of the television, completely sedentary, it's as if the association with your long-term health is as if it's taking half an hour of your life, losing one microlife, essentially, from 2 hours in front of the television. So half hour microlife, you know, if you're watching Frasier, you know, that's actually, you know, you're sitting completely sedentary, actually. That's, you know, knocking, what, 7 minutes
because you're not exercising and doing...
Yeah, and it's actually not... The studies have done this correct for overall energy expenditure as well. So it's no good then just going out to the gym. It's the sedentary behavior. So that's why, quite, you know, very sensibly now, offices concentrate on, you know, standing and moving around and getting people moving all the time during the day. So it's actually very beneficial to keep moving as much as possible. So, and the point is, by using these units, it enables you to compare the stuff, like eating fresh fruit and veg, which is likely to give you on average, it's as if it gives you four microlives a day. Yeah, hours a day.
So actually, what, eating your five a day gives you...
people who do and people who don't is, you know, has got a good effect on life expectancy. And smoking, of course, is chronic. It just takes about 10 years off your life. And so that's like, two cigarettes is about one microlife on average. So we can compare all these
wait
things.
Wait a minute. I'm doing equations in my head.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. No, you can't. You start doing these... the trouble is, public health people don't like people thinking in terms of trade-offs. Yeah. Oh, you know, I've done this exercise so I can have a pork pie.
Five portions of fruit and veg a day and two cigarettes.
There may be diminishing returns for some of these things.
No, exactly.
There are probably other health effects going on.
Exactly. So the point is that you do this. It's all very rough and ready, of course, but they do give you a good feeling for what the relative magnitudes of they are. And of course, you end up with all the stuff that everyone says. Drink moderately, don't smoke, you know, move around quite a lot. Not a huge benefit from excessive exercise at all. The benefit from exercise tails off very quickly. And so you end up with absolutely, you know, standard things, but you're trying to do it in a way that is quite gripping and uses this nice idea of whole numbers of rather than
easily
technical phrases like
single
hazard ratios, which are really tricky to
communicate. And when you say the word risk anyway, people automatically think that's something negative rather than...
No. I give talks to schools a lot, and I now have started to call them the upside of risk. You know, essentially I wanted to, you know, redefine risk as being a good thing, that taking risks is just super. Being reckless is completely idiotic. So you don't want to be Kelvin, but you want to, you know, actually trying to weigh these things up and realizing... go for it.
Another way of thinking about it is to take those couple of extra microlives that you use up by smoking four cigarettes or something like that, as if you did, and say that, well, a couple of hours, it's as if you're racing to death a couple of hours faster every day. Mm. So a normal day is 24 hours long, you know. Mm. So you can imagine that you're burning your way towards your date with the Reaper, you know, at a rate of 26 hours every day of the allotted number of hours that you have. So that's another way of thinking about it. And we're very keen on providing lots of different ways of framing the problem. Mm. It's not that we think any one of these is the definitive right way of understanding your prospects in life. It's that we want to give people different sort of tools for trying to understand the magnitudes. And there's an important word in there, by the way, this as if that David keeps using, because it is clearly not true that if you smoke two fags now, your lifespan is likely to be precisely one half hour shorter. What we're doing there is we're taking the averages again across big, big epidemiological studies, you know, coming several hundred thousand people, and we're dividing them up to a single lifespan and even then into a single day. So it won't be the case that this is a precise description of what's going to happen to you. It's simply a division of the average probabilities.
And again, we're using this idea of metaphor because one metaphor which I find quite powerful and has been used in health communication is effective age. I mean, how old are you effectively? So if you actually, you know, have got a very good diet and getting some exercise, you're knocking years off. You have then got the risks of someone 4, 5, 6 years younger than yourself. And you can do that and measure that mathematically. And that's essentially, you are taking years off your life, essentially. Whereas if you're smoking and being a slob or whatever, you are putting years on your life. You have got the risk of someone who might be 8-10 years older than you. And I think it's a very powerful metaphor of being older than your calendar age.
One other thing I'll mention about it, one of the things that we find attractive about it is that it counters the tendency to think of all these things as deferred. You know, so I'm not going to pay for this until I'm in a rest home in Western Supermare, you know, and I'm dribbling into my oil brand or something like that. You know, if that's the way that you think about it, well, that's okay. It's not going to influence your decisions very much. And maybe that's the right way to think about it. But what micro lives do, or expenditure of time today, is that they bring home the immediacy of what you're doing now, and they say, imagine the effect taking place now. So it's just another way of framing it by giving it
a metaphor of accelerated aging. And people on the idea is most people don't want to get older faster. Probably some teenage girls might want to, but most of us would quite like to delay our aging. If not, get younger.
A lot of the numbers we've talked about and the sort of stats and things do come from essentially lots and lots of epidemiological studies of large populations of people and look at what happens to them. The one thing that those studies can never do and don't do is look at mechanisms. And you're not doing that here, are you? You're not looking at mechanisms. So you're not thinking the smoking is half an hour or whatever because it does this to your body or anything. So it's worth sort of saying that's not what you're doing here at all, is it?
It's associations, yeah. Really. And that's why we use the phrase as if quite a lot, because, you know, who knows? We can't say what's going to happen to you, and we can't say why either. So it's much more, and we don't know what's going to, you know, basically when you've got this lifestyle, as Michael said, you've no idea what the actual long-term impact will be.
So in a sense, what is the purpose then of having this information in front of you? I mean, I can see it's useful because it helps you make decisions. But if it's not telling you actually what's happening to you, then what is it you would say to people who say, well, hang on,
but your standards is crystal ball, if you'll forgive me, you know. Yeah. I mean, no, we can't, but who can, you know? Yeah. I mean, this is beyond the realms of human possibility that we of course we can't tell people what their fate is. Yeah. And that's why we come back to the point that we can give you the best evidence that's available, and then we can allow you to make a decision based as a bit like a bet, as David says, gambling. Think of it as gambling odds is not a bad way of putting the problem.
Yeah, I mean, if you just head out the front, you know, door and start running around London, you know, rushing across roads, and maybe with your eyes closed or something like that, we can't say what'll happen to you. Maybe you'll be all right. We can't not say that. We just say it's pretty. You know, we actually would bet far more higher on you getting run over than otherwise.
I suppose also the numbers you've got then, the micromorts, the microlives, all the other epidemiological stuff, it does help you guide your own decisions in terms of, I know this sounds obvious, but eat the vegetables rather than smoke the cigarettes, for example.
If that's what you want. I mean, it is important. Yeah, we're not trying to tell people how to live.
No.
Yeah. I mean, we offer the information.
Or you can go the other way if you want.
We don't offer a prescription. You can go the other way. You can choose to jump off cliffs with a wingsuit if you really want to. And we can give you the odds for that. We can give you the odds for dying if you want to climb up Mount Everest.
They want to know the odds.
And you can choose that as well as if you want to. I mean, these are aids to decisions. They're not prescriptions for behaviour.
Yeah, I mean, it has sounded as if we're a bit faced and we're wagging our fingers. I couldn't care less what people do. The last thing I want to do is wag my finger at someone and tell them not to do something. That's why we do feature quite a lot on, well, we do a lot on drugs, sex, extreme sports, you know, every sort of reckless activity you can think of, you know, with great glee we examine them, and not necessarily with condemnation.
Well, so I can probably guess, David, what the answer, your answer to this next question is, but Michael, I mean, let me ask you this instead then. What does an appreciation of stats and things like micromorts open up to you? What kind of world does it open up?
Well, I'm an English graduate. You know, I was going to be an aesthete when I was growing up. I was going to discover truth and beauty through poetry and that sort of thing. So, I'm going to call it a great good fortune of meeting people like David. And there's an astonishing thing when you meet good statisticians, I think. And I'm going to tell you, within a Guardian podcast, to aim to redeem the reputation of all statisticians now, is that they have, the good ones, they have a fantastic imagination. And so when I was a journalist in my early days, I used to go out and I'd seek confirmation of my prior beliefs, basically. You know, we talk about standing up a story. You know, we go out and find the evidence to confirm the things that we suspect are already true. And then I come back with my stories and I say, well, it's like this, you know, this is why it's happening and so on. And the good statisticians, they say to you, you sure it's not the money? You sure it's not the age? You sure it's not the sampling or the method or something? You know, and they could just rattle through these other possibilities. And they had a fantastic imagination for disconfirmation, if you like, all the ways in which your impressions of what's going on in the world could be falsified.
Aha moments.
And it was, and that's actually a tremendous intellectual tool to have, because it stops you being the sucker of the easy assumptions that storytellers, I think, can lapse into.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, of course, coming from the other end, what I've been, why the book, I think, I hope, is a good read, and actually funny in many places, is the power of story to bring to life these what can be rather dry numerical, you know, catalogues of statistics. And there are quite a few numbers in the book, but we hope they're, you know, fairly readable because of trying to embed them both in these personal, you know, these brief fictional stories about these ludicrous characters, but also in terms of telling stories from history and things like that, you know, to embed these and make these realize these. First up, you know, people really worked hard to collect this information, and that it's been, you know, won by hard struggle and effort. And I think, you know, that what we've really been struggling with, that's why the book's called Stories and, you know, Stories and Numbers About Risk, is trying to put those two things together, and we hope in a fairly entertaining way. Now, I could give an example. Recently, very sadly, a woman was killed on the what's called the Boris bike scheme, you know, which is the cycling scheme of freely available bikes, or at least, you know, public bikes in London. And this was the first woman who'd been killed on the scheme. And so, you know, this got publicity about, you know, how safe these bikes were. And but the natural response then is to look at the statistics and just look at, you know, realize you can go on the website and realize there's been about, you know, at least 22 million trips on these bikes since they were available. And probably that means about 40 million miles cycled. And from the micromort analysis, I know that you'd expect a death, you know, every 26 million miles on average bikes. Now, Boris bikes might not be quite average because they might be safer in some extents because they're big and clunky and slow and cycled by a safer age rather than very old or very young kids. But they might be more dangerous because they're in London and ridden by tourists, whatever. So, but roughly speaking, although it's a terribly tragic event, this does not, to me, suggest any evidence that they're any more dangerous than other types of cycling.
But that goes into how people perceive risk, actually, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Which is that this may have been something that is predictable from the stats, but then newspapers will concentrate on that one tragic death. And for the family involved, it's incredibly
important.
We've
got a lot of that in the book about the fact that you could think of risk as being basically, you know, a numerator and a denominator. You know, a one out of a
what
million is the simplest thing.
How many people out of are going to die?
And the crucial thing is that newspapers, always remember this, newspapers are narratives like numerators. They only look at the ones where it happened. And they don't report the X million times something didn't happen. Because it'd make a pretty boring newspaper if you wrote that, you know, 3 million children went to school today and came home completely safely. Would not make a really riveting front page. But it would actually be quite a common front page. That's the point. But we hear about the one, and we got some lovely bits in the book about you know, our characters reflecting on this one.
Because we all are the one, you know, and it's a very easy identification to make with the one who comes a cropper in some terrible way. And all the non-events, if you like, just slip from the mind. I mean, what does it even mean to think about a non-event? It's quite hard to conceptualize the idea of nothing happening being important.
Yeah. Well,
but it is important. It is important we systematically screen that out of our attention. Mm-hmm. The non-events, we think they're irrelevant. But actually, for getting a proper sense of the magnitude of risks and so on, they're very important.
And this is really crucial because people, you know, it's called denominator neglect. It's the technical term for this. But when people only hear numerators, they get a hugely inflated idea of how important or how risky something is. That's why people think the crime's going up, whereas actually it's going down. That's why, in fact, that people think there's, you know, more violence against children, where that's been dropping hugely. You know, almost the rarer something gets, the more coverage it gets, and the more important people think it is. So you've got a complete paradox there, driven by the media. Now, I'm not saying media shouldn't report these stories, but you know, I suppose what we say is that, you know, if you're going to do the numerator, stick the denominator in as well.
There's almost a principle, I think, you know, that we mentioned in the book, that the more likely something is to get on telly, the less likely it is to happen. Yeah. And that, you know, our response to the size of these risks is determined by the vividness and the immediacy of the event. So, you know, people think tornadoes are more common than death from asthma. For example, it's been found in one particular study, and actually the numbers are fantastically in the other direction. Now, why is that? Because asthma doesn't kick through, you know, the way that a tornado does on TV. You know, you can make that vivid and arresting.
But it's the whole point, I suppose, isn't it, of journalistic stories, is that you find the thing that's the rarest and the most surprising and all
the
these things.
Story.
And I totally understand that this must be frustrating for you as a professional as a professional statistician. Do you think that there are lessons? I mean, there are definitely lessons for the media to learn. That's not a beginning thing. But do you get frustrated, or do you think you've clearly not just gone and thought, right, they're all stupid, I'm not going to talk to them about this? You're on a bit of a quest to sort of make sure that people out there do know their stats and stuff. But do you still get hugely frustrated by the?
I sympathise hugely with journalism because it is difficult to make the average interesting. You know, in the same way, you know, people like what's odd and different. I mean, there's news.
That's the definition of news.
It's what news is. It's not what is happening to everybody on average.
So you're not suggesting that we should stop doing that?
No, but
I think, you know, you can report these things with a proper sense of proportion. I think that's do both. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not as if we're saying don't do the human interest story because it's so exceptional. Do it because it is exceptional and that makes it interesting.
Exactly.
But get it into proportion. Yeah,
maybe make the rarity of something, you know, actually can be part of the story. The fact that, you know, no passenger has been killed in a train accident for 5 years now in the UK and things like that. So it'll happen eventually, and and that'll get a lot of fuss. And people think that trains are dangerous and demand we spend billions on more safety things, which is nonsensical. So there's ways, I'm sure, to report this better.
Thank you very much, David and Michael. It's been fantastic talking to you, and hope I hope you, when you walk out of here, the micromorts aren't building up.
We'll survive.
I wonder what the micromorts of being in the Guardian office is. Probably about 7 or 8. Okay, thank you very much, both of you.
Thanks.
The Norm Chronicles, Stories and Numbers About Danger, is published by Profile Books and is available in the Guardian online bookshop. We'll have links to it on our blog. And if you don't have time to read the whole thing, you can read John Grace's digested version on the website too. But from me, Alok Jha, aka Kelvin, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, aka Prudence, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.